starting our session. And this is such a poignant event for so many reasons. Not only have we seen the ongoing destruction of our NHS, but in this summer it will be the 70th birthday of our beloved institution. So we need to be making sure, as the People's Assembly, that we mobilise for this event on the 30th of June for the big demonstration in London and start planning how we're going to promote the NHS and the work that it does. So I'm Amelia Womack, I'm the Deputy Leader of the Green Party, and I've got a fantastic panel for you today. We've got John Ashworth, Labour MP for Leicester South, Shadow Health Secretary and Socialist. Danny Dorling, author, journalist and professor at the University of Oxford. Health campaigner, co-chair of Health Campaigns Together, and she stood against Jeremy Hunt in the last general election. So if you could keep using Twitter and social media today, the hashtag is ChangeIsComing and hashtag PA2018, so that's for People's Assembly 2018, and do tag in the People's Assembly so that we can retweet you and amplify our message about the anti-austerity movement here today. So I'm going to begin with Louise. So Louise, if you could take the stage.
Thank you, Louise. Thank you, everybody. I was asked to talk about is the NHS progress. And the NHS is designed to provide universal healthcare, equitable, comprehensive, and free of point of use. And the NHS has been largely successful in those aims. There's been amazing progress in healthcare and health outcomes for the British people. And the Commonwealth Fund, which is an international organisation that ranks health services across many countries, always puts the NHS top for delivering safe, good quality, equitable healthcare. But the NHS is not perfect, and there are still many health inequalities, and there is much room for improvement. Yet, after 8 years of underfunding and a massive structural reorganisation to give yet more inroads to the private sector, we must ask ourselves if it is still fit for purpose. Over the last 8 years, since austerity, economics began to bite, the NHS has begun to fail to deliver decent care for people a lot of the time, a lot of the places. That's not to say the NHS is still providing great care, but we would be dishonest to say that there weren't signs of it cracking the seams. We've seen a performance decline, massive numbers of people lying on trolleys, unable to get a bed. Let's look at The NHS is going through the most austere decade of funding restriction since its inception. An average increase of about 1% per year, which when adjusted for population means virtually no growth at all. But health service costs rise each year, and health service needs are rising each year. So flat funding leads inevitably to cuts and declining quality of care. What about privatisation? Privatisation of the NHS has crept up inexorably, accelerated under the coalition and Tories. Care provided by the private sector, private for-profit organisations, is nearly 8% of the NHS budget and increasing year on year. But that's just direct patient care. There's a whole lot more privatisation behind the scenes that the public does not see, and that's causing havoc. I just need to mention the names: Capita, Carillion, Circle, privatisation of patient transport services, hospital labs, diagnostic services and pharmacies, private finance initiative deals, private provision facilities and buildings, further outsourcing of hospital cleaners, caterers, porters, etc. The NHS is now an unstable hybrid of public and private provision. This is wasteful, fragmented and inefficient. There are too many groups using the NHS's current troubles to advocate change. One group is the advocates of free market liberalism, pushing for privatisation of provision and of funding. They have huge financial resources, groups like the Adam Smith Institute and the Institute of Economic Affairs. And they have huge access to the media for their ideas. And we might think that they're cranks and we might think they're easy to dismiss, but they're having quite a powerful role solving up public opinion for change from a tax funded to public provision. The government does not publicly state its agreement, as they know these ideas are still not popular with the public, but we know the Tories are ideologically committed to shrinking the state and supporting the private sector. There's no doubt their deliberate policy of underfunding the NHS while creating opportunities for the private sector is designed to undermine the NHS as a public service. Then there are those who make more subtle, less direct recommendations for change of the NHS. They call it transformation. They still say that there could be and should be a greater role for the private sector. This is the thrust of government policy now. It's been implemented by Simon Stevens, the chief executive of NHS. Stevens was formerly an advisor to the Blair government. Then he worked with United Health for 10 years. United Health is a huge American multinational health insurer. He offered, and actually United Health, through its changing name to Optum, is giving advice on reconstruction and reconfiguration of NHS services today. Stevens authored the 5-year forward view in 2014. In which advocated new models of care to transform the NHS. The new models of care are called Accountable Care Organisations, ACOs. They've just been named Integrated Care Systems because ACO sounded too American. And that's because they are. They're modelled on US health organisations. ACOs were due to be rolled out in England until the process was stalled by a judicial review brought recently by health campaigners. And we wait for the outcome of that in July. Under ACOs, an enormous contract for a whole area, 10 to 15 years, to provide all health and social care will be put out to tender and could be won by private companies. This will give private health corporations huge opportunities. It's another endless top-down reorganisation that's happening to the NHS, causing massive disruption, which most people do not know about. It's all being done in the name of better planning and integration. But you can have those without ACOs. A return to a publicly provided and organised NHS is entirely feasible. Look at how they're managing healthcare in Scotland, where there is no privatisation of healthcare provision. None of what I've described has happened without resistance. Hundreds of campaigns around the country have either halted some of the cuts and privatisation plans formed to challenge government policy, such as how companies together keep our interests public, and the groups that are bringing the judicial review against ACLs or promoting the NHS reinstatement bill, which will have its next reading in Parliament in July. NHS staff have fought and are fighting important campaigns to maintain their pay and conditions. A powerful movement is building up. We've seen it on the streets in our big demonstrations last March and this February. Hope to see it again on the 30th of June when we celebrate the 70th birthday of the NHS in an event jointly organised by Health Campaigns Together, People's Assembly, the TUC and the health unions. This is a movement that's putting pressure on this government and will demand that any future government acts to protect the NHS. But while we've had some victories, overall we're not winning. The NHS is still being run down and still under great threat. This government is hell-bent on hanging on to power. It should have fallen long ago with what it's doing to the NHS and with examples like Grenfell and the Rush scandal, but it's still there, hanging on. We've got to keep fighting it, but we've also got to look to the future. I have to say that I know the only viable alternative government is a Labour government. We must demand that a future Labour government commit to ending austerity, funding NHS properly. That means funding it by about 4% per year going forward, which is what nearly everybody who knows about, you know, who actually studies health economics says is needed to repair the damage done and to improve the NHS going forward into the future. And it must end privatisation. Austerity is a political choice. There's much evidence that investing in public services such as health and education bring a fourfold return to the economy due to the fiscal multiplier effect. After the Second World War, when debt was 230% of GDP, the Labour government invested in health and public services, and within a decade had fallen to 130%. Anti-austerity policies would improve public health more broadly by addressing housing, jobs, pay, equality, etc., to all impact on physical and mental health. Ending privatisation would not only liberate funds for frontline care, but would enable better joined-up working, which would improve patient care and make the system more efficient and more effective. We need legislation to reinstate the NHS as a public service. That does not just mean repealing the Health and Social Care Act, but legislating for an integrated system based on public ownership and public provision. We can't hope to improve health and the NHS without reversing the cuts to and investing properly in social care. Integration between health and social care would be good for patients, but would only be possible on the basis of free personal social care, as in Scotland. This is something we should be campaigning for and that the new anti-austerity government should aim to achieve. It's really encouraging to read in the news today that Labour is planning to consult on changes that will bring in to reinstate NHS as a public service and to fund it properly. But while hoping for a progressive Labour government, we cannot afford to wait while the NHS crumbles. And that's why we must all keep on campaigning now. So please do get involved in all the events that are coming up, and especially in celebrating and protesting on the 30th of June. Thank you.
Fantastic, thank you very much, Louise. Such a poignant message of the power of campaigning. So that demonstration on the 30th of June to help us mobilise, you can get leaflets at the People's Assembly stall, so please make sure you pick those up and distribute them in your communities to make sure we can make this demonstration the biggest it possibly can be. So next we have Danny Dorling.
Thank you very much. It's an enormous privilege to be speaking between Louise Irving, the person who stood against Jeremy Hunt in the election, and Jonathan Ashworth, the person who stands against Jeremy Hunt in the House of Commons every week. Jeremy Hunt is simply a puppet term. He is a fool, a very useful fool, more interested in buying his flats than his wealth. He is not interested that much in the NHS. He is a front for Simon Stevens, who is the man who is charged with actually it is very similar to Ian Duncan Smith, who was a useful fool in front of David Freud, who actually introduced universal credit. It takes years to begin to work out or think to work out what is really going on with people. And the shock is when you actually realise that the Secretary of State for Health doesn't give a damn. He's just there because it's a bit interesting to do for him between another portfolio of money he's going to learn in another way. I'm very grateful because I was listed as a journalist and author. In this, I thought of this in my actual job title. I have to say I'm here, I've come to negotiate on behalf of the elite. But the elite really are very interesting. And I want, in my remaining minutes, to try to tell you something that you might not know. And that's quite difficult with you guys, because you've heard it all before. So I'll tell you something that I didn't know until a few years ago, I'm going to see if that gets us somewhere. I first started looking at this current health crisis right about 2013, 2014, when we began to get some data saying that healthcare women were dying in greater numbers and life expectancy for that group was dropping by 5 weeks. Just 5 weeks. It doesn't tend to happen very often. It looked a bit shocking. We wrote about it. The response from government was, don't worry, it's just influenza. 2015, 30,000 people excess deaths over winter. The biggest rise we've had since the Second World War in deaths. The Office of National Statistics were shocked. The winter was war. Don't worry, it's just influenza. 2016, the deaths carry on going up. The response carries on being the same, although it's not quite as confidently put. Jeremy Hunt has 24 press officers. 24 press officers in the Department of Health, whose job is purely to try to make Jeremy Hunt look as if he is human being. Now, the response has been more muted, more muted. By the way, those of you who don't know, influenza is an epidemic disease that occurs in large numbers of people only rarely. We had an influenza epidemic in the 1960s, we had another one. Every 15 to 30 years, not every year, not every year we've had these samples actually show, they finally shut down our influenza. This year, first 7 weeks of this year, compared to the last 5 years, which were the most awful 5 years we've had since the war, again, 10,000 more people died than average, despite all non-emergent populations being cancelled for the first time ever for weeks in the NHS to try to prevent that happening. Lord only knows what would have happened if they hadn't cancelled the operations and cleared the wards to cope with what was happening in winter. And it was a warm winter. God knows what's going to happen when we actually get a cold winter, when we actually get influenza. The other news that came out this year, infant mortality has risen 2 years in a row, significantly, not by chance. Short of killing the firstborn, actual rising numbers of dead babies under your watch is unprecedented. You can guess it, when did this last happen? 2 years during the Second World War. In 1990, we ranked 6th or 7th for neonatal mortality in Europe. There were about 5 or 6 countries that didn't better than us. We were pretty good in 1990. We were even better in 1950, we had the first baby rate as well. But 1990, we weren't bad. 2015, we ranked 19th. We ranked 19th. 18 countries, you're better off, you have a better chance of survival of baby in Europe than us. And that was before the rise in the last 2 years. We're heading towards what was the European leader. And it isn't the children of immigrants, because the immigrants are healthy. It's us, it's our babies, it's our grandchildren that have a higher chance of dying. Now, we're actually a couple of people trying to get away from almost anything. It's not just Brexit that means this isn't being reported. There's also a kind of collusion. When 10 doctors, medical doctors, or somebody like me, 10 doctors in the British Medical Journal previous situations have carried on, the BBC didn't touch it. The BBC touches nothing. But if you've got a pen or write something down, UKIP is spelled hugh.pyn @bbc.co.uk. You can email me, he's a health consultant at the BBC, and ask him how many babies have to die before you cover the story. Because I don't. Why doesn't UKIP cover the biggest health crisis that we've had? Because the BBC had to be impartial. And how can you impartially cover a story like that and put the government in a good light? I need to wrap up, so the question is what's going on. The very first, and I'm from this, this is what I think, maybe you or not. I know the Tories aren't nice, I know they're nasty, I know they've got an employment at price worth paying, I don't even care about people losing their jobs at the miners' club cabin. But I thought they care about babies. I honestly did think they cared. What I have come to conclude, because they are not stupid, not all of them, Jeremy Hunt and Ian and Smith are, not all of them. What I have come to conclude is that they deliberately want to degrade the current health and social care system because they believe in their heart of hearts that we need to privatise it and we need the American model here. And they are willing. They are willing for people to die so they can get what they really are. And those people, the people who are most affected in the greatest numbers, are elderly people, they're not necessarily poor people, and they vote for one party above another, they vote for the Conservative Party. And those are the people who are most suffering because of what the Conservatives are doing. But the BBC won't report it, some of the newspapers will, it is very tricky. And then one last story. I have brilliant PhD students. A PhD student comes from a call, they won't come in too much, and is incredibly clever. The PhD student has been in this country for a year, and the PhD student watches the news about Britain. And I took this PhD student to a meeting last week where Rachel Bees left her speaking. I learned a lot from Rachel Bees about what Rachel Bees believes and why the PhD was a problem. And there's an hour and a half of people talking about the Labour Party. And at the end of it, she turned to me and she said, "Who is Jeremy Corbyn?" Because they kept on mentioning Jeremy Corbyn. And she had no idea who Jeremy Corbyn is because she watches the news. She's not stupid, she's not lazy, she watches the news, she knows everything in the news. But she doesn't know who Jeremy Corbyn is because he's not there. It is an uphill slope, but you've never had, as the statistics, so much in your favour. You've never had a situation so dire. You've never had a group of people working in the health service so much on your side. When the NHS was created, the doctors had to be forced to take part in it. They're being offered to pay them what they claim they had been paying on their tax records. And the doctor said they couldn't possibly live on that, so he gave them a little bit more on cost of living. The consultants hated it. In the 1980s, 80% of doctors voted Tory. Now doctors and nurses and leaders, radiologists and midwives are on picket lines. It's unbelievable. It's very... Sometimes you have extremely good luck. I think the very first picket line of John McDonald and Jeremy Corbyn became available to join was junior doctors. You couldn't ask for a better situation to be politically. This is winnable, but you're up against people who in their heart of hearts believe it needs to be prioritised and they will do anything to get their way. Thank you very much.
Fantastic, thank you, Danny. Please do keep tweeting the hashtag #changeiscoming and PA2018 with the People's Assembly tagged in. Also, if you want to build the resistance, then please make sure that you help us with our financial campaign. We very helpfully have this sheet on the back of your programme, which you can complete and hand in at the People's Assembly store so we can continue to resist this Conservative government and the destruction that they're causing on our NHS. So our final speaker is Jonathan, and Jonathan, you can take the stage.
Okay. Well, it is an absolute pleasure to be here this morning, and to answer the question, is the National Health Service, is our National Health Service fit for purpose? Well, let me answer this slightly this way, that a universal, publicly provided and publicly administered National Health Service covering every man, woman and child, free at the point of use, irrespective of the respect based on the national pooling of resources, is of course fit for purpose. The most efficient way of delivering healthcare, but it's also the most equitable way of delivering healthcare. And the challenge and the task for us as socialists and campaigners is to continue to make the case for a public NHS and let no Tory drain confidence from that vision. But we have had 8 years of austerity imposed upon the NHS. 8 years of austerity, which has meant the biggest financial squeeze in this history, as we've heard, with budgets around 1%, which lead in itself to cuts. 8 years of cuts to public health provision and communities, 8 years of cuts to social care provision as well, which we know has a huge impact on the way which healthcare is delivered also. So the crisis the NHS is in today is not because of the concept of a universal public NHS. The crisis it is in is because of years of Tory cuts. The crisis was entirely predictable and was entirely preventable. And it's worth recalling what that crisis means. It means that the waiting list now for the HIV target essentially has been abandoned by the NHS leadership. And now we're 4 million, with experts predicting it will rise to 5 million. We know that no hospital or virtually no hospital have been able to meet the 4-hour A&E target. 2.5 million people waiting beyond 4 hours in A&E. In trolley weights, whereas in the last year of the Labour government, trolley weights in their NHS were around 60,000. You know what they are today, trolley weights? People waiting on trolleys in corridor, but you know what's going on. It's not 60,000. 60,000 is a good enough. Don't get me wrong. It's not 60,000. In the first year of Theresa May's premiership, it wasn't 60,000. It was 565,000 people waiting on trolleys in corridor. And the consequence of these waits, and the consequence of abandoning the HIV target, is that we are seeing more and more people reluctantly leaving the NHS, those who can afford it, and turning to self-pay options. Because if you're being asked then to wait longer and longer for your hip replacement, your cash back removal, or your knee replacement, you're seeing many people in the middle class leaving the NHS and turning to more self-pay options. Not private health insurance, but Jeremy Hunt will tell you that private health insurance isn't picking up, he's correct. But what is picking up is people making one-off purchases of a private treatment and so on. And that is going on now. And we know from years of academic literature that when the middle class flee public service, it tends to leave the lump service for the rest of us. It challenges the very ethos of a public NHS. On top of this, we've had 8 years of undermining, picking fights with the staff, so that we now have 100,000 vacancies across the National Health Service, for short of 36,000 nurses, short of 10,000 doctors. The number of GPs in our communities has fallen by over 1,000 in the last 18 months or so. There's more nurses leaving the profession and entering the profession. And because of Brexit, our applications to the EU are falling, and this year we celebrate 70 years of the Windrush generation. We've got a government with a hostile, it's a deliberate, hostile environment, turning down the visas for clinicians and nurses from across the world who want to come to work in our NHS to care for our sick and care for our elderly. The government have got another bursary, a training bursary for our nurses and midwives, which means the applications for nurses and midwives have dropped. Fancy that, they get the bursary and then drops if you put on that. And of course, 8 years of pay and strength, we've had a situation where the low bar nurses are literally stopping at a food bank on their way home from shift to pick up a food parcel to feed their family. This is what is going on for 8 years of austerity in the National Health Service. So what is Labour's response? Well, first of all, we would put the money in, we would fund the NHS public. An extra $7 billion if we were in part of the new government this year to fund our health and social care sector. would actually give the staff a proper pay rise, get another pay cut and a fair pay deal, and would bring back the training bursary as well for a recruiting staff. But we have to do something else as well. Because if I'm your Home Secretary, I aspire to be your Secretary of State, increasing the funding on the national accounts that is going into the National Health Service, then that funding has to be nationally and publicly accountable. But money flowing out of the NHS into the private sector is not nationally accountable. So we have to end the privatisation of our NHS as well. And the reason we end the privatisation of the NHS is because some Tory was having a go at me on Twitter today, and you don't document it, right? It's because we know that when the private sector wins these contracts, they deliver a quality service which is not in the interest of patients and not in the interest of taxpayers. I'll give you a couple of great good examples. Carillion, we all know about Carillion, it's bad. Carillion had a cleaning contract at Nottingham University Health Trust. They had to lose that contract because they left infectious waste flowing through the children's ward. Interserve had a contract at the Women's Hospital. They had to lose that contract, cleaning contract, because they left blood splattered across the walls of the ward. Or what about Cumbria and Cumberland? They were a patient transport contract, typical patients, non-emergency ambulation contract as well, typical patients for a dialysis appointment or a chemotherapy appointment. They were leaving patients stranded on their doorsteps. The firm won the contract, subcontracted to 20 other firms, two of the firms on a bus, and the ambulance driver went for 8 weeks without wages. Again, that contract had to come back in house. So we were ahead of this privatisation, move towards a system where we're bringing contracts back in-house. You can call it the reinstatement of the story, you can call it renationalisation of the NHS, if you like. But that's where we've got to get to. Which is why today I've said we've got to get rid of the Lansley Health and Social Care Act. We've got to restore the NHS, and I want to consult with all of you over the coming months about how we best do that, because I understand that, and it's great to start with the staff who always say we don't want to be top down the organisation, and I understand that and accept that. But if we want to move away from this fragmentation and this privatisation to a more collaboration, partnership and planning at a local level, then we've got to change some of the way in which the NHS works. And that does mean bringing forward an NHS bill so we can reinstate the NHS. That is something I want to do. Where many trusts are outsourcing facilities management staff into something called wholly owned subsidiaries. This is where cleaning staff, catering staff, grounds management staff get shunted over to a private company that the NHS hospital owns itself, with the risk that new staff will not be on the same terms and conditions, and the ultimate risk that it's a package that can be sent out to completely privatised. This is going on now because of underfunding, because trusts get a VAT advantage for doing it. We've got a campaign against it. And Dan talks about picket lines. I can tell you that I, as a Shared Health Secretary, have sent my solidarity and support to those union members who have taken industrial action so far, like at Wigan last week, and it's my intention to join the picket line. Just in closing, there's lots of other areas to cover, but I'm sure there's time for questions. Just in closing, this is the 70th anniversary of the National Health Service. It was a great Labour creation by that radical socialist government of Clement Attlee with Nigel Evans as the Secretary of State for Health and Housing. And it was voted against 20 times by the Tories, and we shouldn't forget that. We should always remind them of it. But I went better than the rate of the NHS, we call it this great civilising moment that we lived the shadow. And he called it socialism in action. And we are in a church, he also called it Christianity in action as well. But he said it was about equality. And yet here we are, 70 years later, with health inequalities getting wider and wider. The number of admissions to hospitals for malnutrition have doubled in the last 8 years. In our communities now, there is a thing called DIY dentistry, where you can buy one of these. You can buy it from a sort of B&M type store, and you do your own fill-ins because if you cannot afford to go and see a dentist, this is going on. And as Darlene has said, with great evidence, that health inequalities for some of our children and some of our very poorest children are actually going backwards. And if you look at our mortality rates compared to other Western nations, we actually fare so much worse on things. things like non-digital child health outcomes. So as well as ending prioritisation, building up capacity, building up putting the money back into our NHS, I think that a big task for the next level of government is a big assault on these health inequalities in society as well. And just finally, the anxious for the chair is getting frustrated. Finally, when they say to you as campaigners, as they always do, where is the money coming from? How are you going to fund it? We must always remind them that the NHS is wasting billions on the private sector. But this is a Tory government that's cut billions in corporation taxes, a Tory government that's cut billions in inheritance tax cuts for the richest of the states, a Tory government that's given £1 billion to the DUP. And this, in the 70th year of the National Health Service, if they could build an NHS from the rubble, the carnage, the austerity of the 1940s, then my God, we can do it again in 70 years later.
From the floor. We're going to have questions until about 1:05 and then we'll have something up from the group. So can I have a person up front here? Thank you very much. I'll wait for three questions before coming back to the panel. The person in the middle there, just on the right.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your contribution and for each of you makes an extremely bad point. I'm an ideological second generation person of the NHS. And to be quite honest with you, without talking about my case, I don't know where the NHS is going. When half the NHS budget is spent on legal costs, I think that that is something we need to tackle. What I found in the NHS is that we have a strong foundation of dedicated workers who devote the times, their lives to the NHS. However, decision making is made by a small proportion of people, and these people are not getting their voices heard, and I think that is leading to mismanagement. If we do want our NHS, we have to go back to the principles of relevance, and it has to be locally based, community based, and we also have to not have a clinically led NHS.
And person at the front on the left-hand side here.
One thing that concerns me about the NHS at the moment is the way in which private health companies like Virgin are now to sue the NHS for not being able to take up contracts. I'm wondering if the main party would do, if they got into power, with the technical issue of stopping this, basically. And is it in connection with the new competition law which would make it difficult to stop these privatisations and the way in which private companies can sue for the loss of contracts, which would happen with renationalisation?
Yeah, I'm going to bring it back to the panel, but if the panel could be... Sorry, yes, that was a great question. If the panel could be quick, we can get a couple more background questions in.
Yeah, so I think it's absolutely outrageous that Virgin Care can sue the National Health Service in Surrey, in Jeremy Hunt's own backyard,
sued the CCG there, which we think they forced the CCG to pay out. I think 1.3 million emerged, I think, in one of the documents that emerged, because they didn't actually win a children's health contract. Virgin have just won another children's health contract in Lancashire, which I think is now being challenged in the courts as well. But of course, I want to move to a system where these community health contracts are not going to the Virgin Cares of the world. In fact, I didn't write the word contract. I want to move to a system where you're planning healthcare delivery. And actually, the privatisation debate in the NHS, when it comes to particular services, and you touched upon this, is actually increasingly in the community health sector, where you see children's health contracts, health visiting contracts, school nurses contracts, or local 111 contracts, or non-emergency ambulatory contracts going to these private providers. 9 billion, roughly, at the moment. And they often provide, well, they always provide poor quality. And actually, you really need to bring these contracts back in-house. So our whole concept is on a different approach. We're moving away from this sort of any qualified provider approach, which is what the Lansley Act is all about. We don't want the Virgin Cares involved in the delivery of healthcare. So that situation shouldn't really arise. But some of this, you know, I've got to be sort of frank with you. We don't know when a general election is going to be. This government could last in 2022. Sometimes if things have been out for so many years, it may cost us and take us a bit of time to start bringing these things back in-house, if you see what I mean. But that is definitely our intention. And I think the point over here is really well made about, we need to get back and restore the NHS to the Bevanite principles. I absolutely agree. We shouldn't be wasting all this money on constant competitive tendering of contracts, having solicitors crawling all over it all the time. It's wasting money that should be going to patient care, and the delivery of services should be local and clinically led, as you quite rightly said. And I think your point was about wheelchair provision, and this is something which I know costs individuals a lot, and a lot of charities have to step in. It's something I'm looking at, and in the coming weeks I'm hoping to meet one of the charities, national charities, have been in touch with me about this. So although I've not necessarily got an announcement for today, it's something I'm aware of and I'm going to look into.
Thank you. I wanted to just reply to the point about competition law, and whether because of competition law we would not be able to renationalise the NHS. Actually, that's not true, because if you have a nationalised service, competition law doesn't apply. Mm-hmm. So we just have to look at Scotland. Scotland actually got rid of all private provision of healthcare, I think it was 1990, and it's therefore not subject to competition law. So it's also one of these kind of lies that, all because we're part of Europe, we have to put everything out to tender. The European competition law says that once you have a service that has become marketised, when tenders are being made, then it has to be done fairly. That's what they would argue, it all has to be put up to tender on the international market. But if you have a non-marketised system of public service, then there is no obligation. You look at Scotland, I think, is a very good example. Okay, it's a smaller population than England, but we can learn lessons from there. They have health boards that are involved in population-based planning. They use public health expertise to look at the health needs of the population and plan for how they can be met. Public health in England has been completely marginalised. The government doesn't even bother even talking to public health experts. They use McKinsey's and United Health, etc., to plan their service reconfigurations, etc. We need to go back to proper public health planning. There's also, for example, in New Zealand, where in New Zealand they brought their health service back into public ownership, and again, they managed that very well, fairly seamlessly and fairly effortlessly. It would not require a major top-down reorganisation. It would be felt as a front line. On the front line, it would be felt as a great benefit, I can tell you, and I think it's something we could be doing in a very straightforward way.
Everything is connected. On the lawyers, we have more lawyers per head than anywhere else in Europe, and that's partly why we have so many cases. Jeremy Hunt celebrates the cases of the NHS being sued and gives people awards because he wants it to go. But, and on Virgin, part of the way I think we need to deal with Virgin, apart from obviously not letting it compete or be involved at all, not just health but also the trains, is to look at some of the messages the Tories give us about health. And they say that we need to look after ourselves, we need to not smoke, we need to go walking, we need to keep fit. And then you need to look at, well, how can you do that? Now, I used to live in Sheffield, and it was relatively easy in Sheffield because we had a national park and you could walk into it. But now I live back in the city I grew up in Oxford, and you find out that it's all privatised, all of the city around me is privatised. So we need national parks in the south and the right to roam in the south. And if I walk out of my house and north, the first big private estate I get to, next to the banks of the Charwell River, just happens to be owned by Richard Branson. And I would like that to be the first estate at some point in future. He can still own it. We just have footpaths all over it, and he has a responsibility to make sure they're safe and neat for us.
Add a story to the ridiculousness of the situation, because our Green Party councillor in Bath was threatened with being sued by Virgin Care because she signed a petition to keep the NHS public and said that she was highlighting a bias that she had in her political decision making. Now, if you're a councillor and you're being sued for signing a petition, then the private companies are just completely ignoring the rights of people and the rights of the general public and what democracy is. So we'll take three more questions. I want to get some people who are a little bit further to the back. So the person just in the middle here with the black top on.
Hello, I just want to ask please,
So we'll get somebody, the person with the black top on the left-hand side up here.
Hello, yeah, Tony Dowling, I think this is happening more things to Newcastle. The Tories are terrified of the NHS because they're desperate to get their hands on the vast amounts of money in the NHS, but they're also terrified about the NHS because it's a demonstration of practice that socialism works, and that's really the thing that terrifies them. Now, back in 2015, we were all very visible because the Tories had won the election. Several weeks later, there were lots of demonstrations around the country, culminating on the 20th of June, a quarter of a million people on the streets in the city. It was a semi-national demonstration in London. A few weeks later, I was at a meeting in London at which Jeremy Corbyn was talking. This was before he was the leader of the Labour Party, before he was actually on the ballot paper. And he talked then about the fact that demonstration in which he spoke had put austerity and anti-austerity on the national narrative to be discussed in political circles. What we need to do is the same thing with the NHS. On the 30th of June this year, we need the NHS demonstration to put the narrative of saving our NHS and renationalising our NHS back into the central narrative of this parliament and the struggles of this country. And I think means that every single Labour Party member and constituency party needs to get out on the streets. If we're to believe that there are 600,000 Labour Party members now, we should be able to at least get 600,000 people on the streets on the 30th of June. tune. So let's make that a reality and get over a million people on the streets to say hello.
And just to be annoying to the people with the mics, the person on the far right over here, far right, position-wise, clearly not
visible. Never mind.
Well done, the far right. It is a problem.
If the panel could just ask those questions and sum up, we'll give you just over 2 minutes each.
That's done.
Yeah.
Okay. The one at the back about. They do hate the NHS because it shows that you can organise things like this and it works. All the academised privatised schools could be taken back into something that's better. The railways could be taken back into something better. The privatised universities can be taken back into public ownership. We now are all privatised, you just haven't noticed it quietly happen. That's part of the hatred. On the cost, if you remember the bus with 350 million a week on its side, 350 million, if you want the equivalent health service that they have in Germany, that bus needed to actually say 1 billion, 1050 million. So how on earth do the Germans do it? How do they manage to fund a health service so much better? How do they do it in France, when they spend a quarter more on their healthcare and they have spare beds for people? How do they do it in Switzerland? Switzerland is hardly a radical country, but they spend twice as much on health per person than we do. And the way they do it is because they care. They don't waste money on other things, such as such a large army and so many interventions abroad in the military, but they also tax properly. At the last election, the debate between Labour and the Conservatives was a debate between the Conservative Party, who wanted to bring public spending down to 36% of GDP, and a radical Labour manifesto written by Andrew Fisher that would take it to 37%. A 1% difference. It was radical. It is brilliant. It's difficult. We are where we are in Britain, and it's hard to argue for that 1% difference. Labour would spend 37%, Tories 36%. You're right, 4% a year increase in the NHS is what you need. What does France spend? 50% of GDP. What does Finland spend? 54% of GDP. What does every other bloody country in Europe do? They tax people on over €50,000 more because they think that their fellow citizens are human beings, and they provide state schools for everybody, not just for the bottom 93%, and they provide hospitals and care for everybody at a higher rate than we do. There is nowhere else in Europe, not even Greece, spends less on its healthcare per head than we are doing now. It's entirely possible, but you have to move the window of what people can imagine is possible. You have to say, look what they're doing over there, ask why they're living longer. In Norway and Finland in the last 3-4 years, life expectancy has been rising by a third of a year. It is cold in Norway and Finland. Of all the countries of Europe that Eurostat produced the statistics for between 2010 and 2018, only one country in Europe has had no rise in life expectancy. Only one in Europe, and that is us. We are the Texas of Europe. Thank you very much.
Deborah asked, is public service a good thing in its own right? And of course, I would say absolutely yes, I think everybody in the room. It exemplifies the concept of social solidarity, that we all contribute what we're able to, and we all take what we need. And this is something that the Conservatives found absolute anathema, because it actually shows there's another way of organising our public services and within our society that doesn't rely on the market. Social solidarity and the public service ethos of the NHS also means that we have an equitable NHS by and large, also that it's also more efficient, cost-effective, and has better outcomes. So it's actually better for everybody, even in a hard-nosed economic way, it makes sense to have a public service, never mind all the other good things that come from it, in terms of how it feels to both work in it and also to be a patient in it. You asked about silent seasons and the sustainable energy conservation plans, and people probably know that this is the precursor to the accountable care organisations, where, again, it's only affects England, but where England is divided into 44 so-called footprints, and they're meant to reorganise services so that they can stick to budgets, or, for example, making cuts of about between £500 million and £1 billion every year by 2020, by transforming services, which actually practice means closing and cutting services like RAs and our utilities. I haven't seen much of it, it's been a positive transformation. It's worth remembering that Simon Stevens was a senior participant in the Davos conferences, which were looking at ways for the international private sector to break into new markets for healthcare. And Davos was promoting the idea of accountable care organisations across the world. So great, you know, he's in the UK promoting it here, but this is an argument that's been made worldwide, and we have to be able to counter it. We have to be able to say, yes, we want better integration and we want better coordination and better planning, but we do not need the private sector to be running those services in order for that to happen. As I've said before and I will say again, we only need to look at other examples within the UK itself to see that there are other better ways of organising and delivering healthcare. On the issue of ethnic minorities, I think that I did say that the NHS is pretty good, but there are inequalities. There are inequalities in geographical ones, there are class inequalities, and there are also people who are ethnic minorities actually have got representatives of worse health, their worse health outcomes. So we can't just address the models, we do have to fight to make NHS even better. As a GP, I've actually got patients who've lived and worked in the UK for many, many years. Of course, I was a person who came to the UK in the 60s as a child of the Windrush generation. He came to the UK when he was 14 in the 1960s, and he's had to ask us to provide evidence for the Home Office that he's actually lived here. I'm sure that each and every year we've got evidence that he was registered in our practice. And we know that even that's not enough. We take 4 pieces of evidence. And our practice is doing all we can to support patients like that, but it is absolutely disgusting that people are having to go through that. And I think that that's what I meant by carrying on fighting now. It's not just for the future, a future living longer, we hope, but now we have to fight to defend people's rights to equitable healthcare.
Thank you. What I should have said on the previous round is that you see a lot of these firms like Virgin Care becoming increasingly aggressive in the courts. So whoever it was who mentioned the, which you were talking about the councillor in Bath, that doesn't surprise me, because although these firms tend to, they don't tend to they got their fingers burned, if you like, when they tried to unhitch in Brook Hospital, so they don't tend to go for those services. But these very different community health services, when they don't win contracts, they've been very, very aggressive in the tendering process, and it's why the whole way in which this is structured now is such a complete mess. On the point about, do I believe that the NHS is a public service, a public good? Yes, of course. Because the delivery of healthcare is a human right, as far as I'm concerned. And the NHS is about public good. So that is why I want a publicly provided, publicly administered national health service. It's why I don't want a national health service which is pushed towards privatisation as it has been in recent years. And on the point about the sustainability transformation plan, look, in some ways, as you were sort of alluding to, we're not against, I don't think, asking your local acute sector to work alongside your district nursing service and your GPs and your public health provision and your mental health services. But I don't think we're against bringing them together and collaborating together, working in partnership or partnership planning, as I call it. You might even want to call it district health authority, for example. But what we are against is forcing them together and then bundling all the contracts together and then putting all those contracts out to tender with the very real risk that a private provider, maybe even an American private provider, could come in and get hold of that contract, which is why there is so much legitimate concern about the ACOs, and why in which we put down what you call some prayer motion in Parliament to try and block them and vote against them in the House of Commons. And it's why, when you look at these SNP plans, actually, when you look into the detail, you see that a lot of these SNP plans are actually about multi-billion pound savings across the country. In other words, cuts. And usually savings mean either letting go of staff or cutting back on capacity. But we've already lost 16,000 beds in the NHS since 2010. We've lost around 5,000 mental health beds in the NHS since 2010. And actually what the consequence of that is, I think we all accept people want to be treated back in their home, and you don't want to be lying in a bed for days and days and days and days if they don't need to be in a bed. But the problem is we've cut so many beds that increasingly the NHS, particularly mental health services, has had to buy beds from the private sector. Particularly mental health services, sending people to poor quality private providers because the beds have been cut back in the mental health sector. And this is the big fear with a lot of these SDPs, is that they'll find their money by cutting back on this capacity and cutting back. The number of families, addiction services, the number of in-house detox beds have been absolutely slashed right back over the last 8 years. And there actually isn't the quality addiction services that we expect. I mean, in the last year alone, 43 million has been cut from drug and alcohol addiction services. So, look, you know, you've got to put the money in, and you've got to start building up capacity again to have public provision, so rather than relying on private sector mental health services, for example, you've got beds again in the public sector. And on the mental health act, you're quite right to raise concerns about the mental health act, and particularly the way in which it affects black minority ethnic communities. It has to be looked at again. We want to look at it again. There is actually a review of it going on led by the former president of the Royal Society of Psychiatrists at the moment as it happens, but we agree that it's probably 30 years old and needs to be looked at again. And just sort of describing that we have got to get to a system where we're putting the money in and we're expanding public provision in the NHS, so we're not relying on these poor quality private providers. We want to bring contracts back in the NHS. But also, we have got to really tackle these big health inequalities in society. You know, our child health outcomes are disgraceful when we compare ourselves to other equivalent sort of Western European nations. Not just our mortality rates. Our children leave school, more of our children leave school obese. More of our children have asthma. More of our children have to return to child and adolescent mental health services and get a very poor quality service, by the way, from child and adolescent mental health services. Our children don't get the levels of immunisation they should have if you compare us to other equivalent nations. The dental health of our children is still very poor relative to other Western European nations. And this is yes, about capacity in the NHS, but it's also about tackling those wider social determinants of health. It's about dealing with housing. It's about dealing with the public space. It's about dealing with the air that we breathe. It's about dealing with the benefits of the austerity economy
and the way in which wages operate so on in society. So if we want a big all-out solve on health inequalities, which is what I want as the next health sector, hopefully, it means we've got to change so many structural things in society as well. But I think we can only do that if we get a socialist Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn in the coming years. Thanks a lot.